Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, August 10th, 2015. Disruption is the political watchword of 2015.
You can't shut me up, can't hush my mouth. I'll bang and drum, I'll be so loud. You can't cover up the truth with duct tape. Boy, it's gonna hit you like an earthquake.
Lindsay L. is the songbird opening our podcast today. Can somebody shut Donald Trump up? I don't think so. The corporate media in this country keeps enabling him to say shocking things, and then they express shock that he has once again delivered on their expectations. And so following the contentious, they say, debate, where Megyn Kelly asked, or at least posed as asking some tough questions of Trump, he went on a Twitter rampage, exposing his own dark side. He's got some real problems with women, and misogyny is not too strong a word to describe it. Megyn Kelly nailed him with the history of his commentary on women. And he basically told her, you know, he's not politically correct and she ought to just get over it. Then following the debate, there were these all-night tweet fests. And, of course, the media picked up on it and got him to expand on those, and I'm using air quotes here, thoughts. And Donald Trump has ADHD or some difficulty like that, because you'll notice that he often starts to say something and then loses interest and moves on without actually completing a sentence. And that's what I think he did when he was slamming Megyn Kelly on MSNBC on Friday, when he said that, you know, she was so angry she had blood coming out of her nose and blood coming out of her wherever. Then he went on, rambled on to something else. And so now the corporate media not only enables him, sets him up, acts shocked when he says these things, but they also complete his sentences and interpret what he didn't say. And so the spin that has been put on this is he was referring in an oblique way that perhaps Megyn Kelly was menstruating. And honestly, I think that's pretty far-fetched. And in response, Trump says, well, you got to be a degenerate to think that's what I meant. And frankly, you know, all of this is much ado about nothing. And I refuse to become a defender of Donald Trump. But I will say that I'm not that comfortable with people who flatly say that they know what he meant and that he was denigrating her for being a woman and having a menstrual cycle. And then it continued on all the Sunday talk shows. They couldn't get Trump to leave his penthouse, so he phoned into all these shows. And he just goes deeper and deeper each time. And the media keeps saying, well, you know, we want to be there when he self-destructs. And honestly, I think he is enjoying this attention so much. He's got an ego bigger than all outdoors. That this just eggs him on. He will stay in the race, if only to defy those who have predicted that any day now he will leave. And whether he jumps to a third party or stays with the Republicans, he's going to be a factor until he decides he won't be. And I don't think there's much that people like you and me can do to affect that in any way. And so we just kind of hunker down for this shitstorm that is underway. And what amazes me is over the weekend, I stepped out of my, you know, comfort zone and I had dinner with some people I hadn't met before who are clearly Republican, leaning conservative. And they kind of think, well, Trump's just telling it like it is. He's the new Ross Perot. And then yesterday, I was hanging out with my neighbor, and she and I have very different political views. And often, I don't bring things up because I just kind of know where it goes, right? But she asked, hey, Peter, what'd you think of that debate the other night? And I responded saying, well, she said, did you like anybody? And I joked and said, well, Megyn Kelly. And then we had this exchange that I want to share with you, because my neighbor said, well, you know, Trump is getting attention and connecting with people because the government doesn't work. It's broken. And I said, well, yeah, that's the Republican plan. They articulated that the day that Obama was sworn in as president. They block everything that he or the Democrats propose. And then, really unaware of her own incoherence, she said, well, that's good because Obama's wrecking the country and dividing us, and we need to stop everything that he tries to do. She went on a tirade about Obamacare, and you know I'm not a big fan of Obamacare. But my neighbor is a Fox News junkie, and she buys all that stuff that they're selling. And so within 30 seconds to go from the government doesn't work to, well, that's a good thing because it blocks Obama, it shows the kind of American mindset of the so-called low-information voter, I'm afraid, that makes Trump a very potent force in this era of incoherence. Now, the other kind of obstruction or disruption that occurred over the weekend drew a lot of attention to Bernie Sanders and progressives. This occurred in Seattle, where two African-American women waited for Bernie Sanders to be introduced to speak. And as he started to approach the podium and begin to speak, these two women came up and basically told him that because Black Lives Matter, they were going to take over this rally. And I'm very uncomfortable with this tactic. And I'm also very uncomfortable with the target they selected. Because of all the people running for president, Bernie Sanders is the one most sympathetic to their cause and most willing to address the systemic underlying problems that affect Black Americans. And these people probably didn't have an opportunity to conduct the same kind of intervention with a Donald Trump or go to the Koch brothers confab in Southern California a week ago. And so this was their opportunity. They saw that this Sanders rally didn't have much security, and basically they could just jump up on the stage if they wanted to. And that represents a kind of trust between the Sanders campaign and the public, where he's saying, you know, I don't need a bulletproof vest. I don't need 100 security guards to keep me away from people. And so in my view, they abused that trust. And I understand that they consider the lives of Black Americans to be at risk every day, and that they consider this to be a crisis that they cannot wait any longer to be addressed. I do get that. At the same time, their tactics are counterproductive. And the crowd of mostly white liberals who had been waiting in the heat of the afternoon sun reportedly turned on these Black activists. And so here we have, among self-styled progressives, a struggle that's unnecessary, that doesn't move really the issues in any significant way, and creates a negative media moment that basically makes everyone look bad. And I think it's fair to say that Bernie Sanders could have been more forceful in addressing these issues, and he could have gotten to it sooner. But this approach, I think, is poor judgment. And it raises questions. There's all kinds of stuff on the blogosphere right now. For example, one of the two women, Marissa Janae Johnson, when people scoped out her Facebook post, has described herself as a Sarah Palin supporter, at least in the past. And as you know, the Black Lives Matters movement is a bunch of self-appointed, self-styled people. That's not to say that they don't have good motives or good aspirations. But there is no Black Lives Matter headquarters. where people check in and say, hey, you think we ought to burn the burn again? And so I think that we have to look for ways to try to build consensus and try to build some sort of unity around these issues. I'm linking in the show file for this podcast to a powerful blog post that was written by a state senator from Washington State, Pramila Jayapal. She was on the stage and spoke right before Senator Sanders on Saturday. And she also spoke later that evening at the rally that was not interrupted. And by the way, Bernie Sanders attracted 28,000 people in Portland on Sunday. His campaign is really building steam. And in a moment, I'll describe the new manifesto on racial justice that Bernie Sanders has announced. And it's fair to say that this is in part triggered by what happened at Netroots Nation in Phoenix, 3 weeks ago, and by what happened on Saturday in Seattle. So I'm not denying that this has an impact, but I think that these kinds of tactics have to be very carefully used, or they run the risk of counterproductivity. So Senator Jayapal wrote that this really grieved her. The headline is, Saturday's Bernie Sanders rally left me feeling heartbroken. She begins by saying that this is one small result of centuries of racism. I acknowledge that and I understand it. And she says when the disruption first happened, the mostly white crowd turned ugly. She says it's hard to say what is the chicken or the egg. Some of it may have stemmed from the protesters calling the whole crowd racist. Some of it was from annoyance at the disruption. Some was probably from deep disagreement about tactics, some from deep disappointment because people had stood in the hot sun for hours to hear Bernie, not these two women, who prevented him from speaking. She says, whatever it was, the conversations that ensued, the name-calling of white and black people against each other, were so painful. And I share that. I share that sense of pain, and as someone who has worked very hard to expose the wrongdoing to African Americans. And I've been doing this for more than 40 years. Is that right? Yes. I had to count and check. All right, so the senator goes on to say, I don't have any answer on what is right. Bernie Sanders was a guest invited by a multiracial coalition to speak. Enormous amounts of work went into it. And the message about expanding Social Security and Medicare was completely lost because of these tactics. She goes on to say that she had a personal sidebar conversation with Bernie Sanders about race issues and came away quite encouraged, saying, I believe Bernie Sanders is growing, and I hope that we'll look back on this and see his emergence as a leader who brings our movements for economic, racial, and social justice together in a powerful way. And her final comment is, as a brown woman, the only woman of color in Washington State Senate, often the only person of color in many rooms, she's constantly thinking about how do we call people in even as we call them out. She says, to build a movement, we have to be smarter than those who are trying to divide us. We have to take our anger and rage and channel it into building, growing, loving, holding each other up. But in the end, if we want to win for all of us on racial, economic, and social justice issues, we need multiple sets of tactics working together. Some are disruptive, some are loving, some are truth-telling. Some can only be taken by white people, and some can only be taken on by people of color. Well, I think her message is powerful, thoughtful, not full of blame, and I encourage you to read it and see if you embrace it. So today, Senator Sanders, who has named an African-American woman named Simone Sanders as his press secretary for the campaign, unveiled a new racial justice platform aimed at four key elements: physical violence from law enforcement and extremist vigilantes, the political violence of voter suppression, the legal violence of the war on drugs and mass incarceration, and the economic violence of crushing poverty. And I, of course, support this initiative from the Sanders campaign. And I hope that we'll see more detail on it. And I hope that we can see African Americans understanding that while Sanders is a white guy, 70s, from a very white state, he has a history of fighting for the rights of others. And I hope that they won't treat him like a Donald Trump. Because that was the uncomfortable feeling I got when I watched the video of these two women staging this interruption of Sanders in Seattle on Saturday. And over the weekend was the 1 year, you don't call it an anniversary, it was an observance of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And the day was tense but peaceful until the late evening, when shots were fired, and police say that they shot a man, they haven't identified his name or his race, after he engaged in trading gunshots with others in the crowd. Now, one of the things that remains to be seen, because we can't trust, right, the official pronouncements that come from law enforcement in St. Louis and particularly in Ferguson, they reported that the wounded man was among two groups firing at each other. Four plainclothes officers who had watched the man run across a parking lot drove their unmarked sport utility vehicle with its interior lights flashing toward him, and the man responded by shooting at the officers, and they returned fire. But despite what they're describing as this provocation, they did not apparently shoot to kill. And as a minimal step, I can say that that's a good thing. But we don't know how many Homeland Security provocateurs or informants were infiltrating the crowd of marchers. There's a lot that we don't know here. And the Ferguson Action Council, via Kayla Reed, a field organizer, said after a year of protest and conversation around police accountability, having plainclothes officers without body cameras and proper identification in the protest setting leaves us with only the officer's account of the incident, which is clearly problematic. And early today, another shooting occurred after a gunman fired at two men walking on the sidewalk near the memorial for Michael Brown in the Canfield Green Apartments, just a few steps away from where he was shot and killed a year ago. And after hundreds gathered around the spot where Brown was killed, there was then a march led by Brown's father to a nearby church. And there was a looting episode as a large crowd broke into a beauty supply store, grabbed a cash register, and as they were fleeing, police intervened and they tossed that cash register aside. With Jon Stewart's departure from late night TV, I feel a real loss. I saved the John Oliver show from HBO to watch tonight, so I have a little political satire to ease my withdrawal. But I was struck by an op-ed piece in the Sunday New York Times by a man I've never heard of before, Gerard Alexander. He is described as an associate professor of politics at the University of Virginia. And his perspective is clearly that of a conservative. And he describes Jon Stewart as the patron saint of liberal smugness. And he offers an indictment that includes people like me. He writes, many liberals, but not conservatives, believe there is an important asymmetry in American politics. These liberals believe that people on opposite sides of the ideological spectrum are fundamentally different. Specifically, they believe that liberals are much more open to change than conservatives, more tolerant of differences, more motivated by the public good, and maybe most of all, smarter and better informed. Now, I plead guilty. I probably do deliver a sense of liberal smugness. I do believe that my perspectives are superior to those of conservatives, who I find to be irrational and incoherent in what they call logic in support of many of their positions. Let me just take an example. The orchestrated effort that's underway and that will probably succeed in taking down Planned Parenthood, Now, this is being driven by abortion opponents who see Planned Parenthood as the evil, just a bunch of baby killers. Now, we know that only 3% of Planned Parenthood's budget goes to abortion services. And so they want to shut down the entire organization. And that other 97% is for cancer screenings of the breast and the reproductive organs, for treatment of gynecological needs, just basic health care, treatment of sexually transmitted diseases and prevention of their spread. And yes, I think it's irrational, incoherent, and short-sighted, even for people who are pursuing a ban on abortion, to try to take out Planned Parenthood. And so, yes, Professor Alexander, I plead guilty as a smug liberal who thinks that I'm smarter, better informed, and that the people on the other side are morons who are pursuing purely political targets, irrespective of the cost. So let's return to the op-ed here from Professor Alexander. The evidence for these liberal beliefs that he described is not good. Liberals turn out to be just as prone to their own forms of intolerance, ignorance, and bias. But the beliefs are comforting to many. They give their bearers a sense of intellectual and even moral superiority, and they affect behavior. They inform the condescension and self-righteousness with which liberals often treat conservatives. They explain why many liberals have greeted Tea Partyers and other grassroots conservatives with outsized alarm. They explain why liberals fixate on figures such as Sarah Palin and Todd Akin, who represent the worst that many liberals are prepared to see in conservatives. And so, I have to say that he has a point. But in making his point, he is unable or unwilling to recognize the idiocy of many of the policies that I am smugly condescending about. You can find that op-ed in the New York Times. If I get around to it, I'll put up a link that you can click on to read it for yourself. Every day, I pause to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Today, I'm going to single out the people who do more than they have to, because you can sign up for a $5 a month subscription. That's the lowest price. But Julie Dupree, Andy Krieger, Joe Carson, and Janet Price, they all elect to kick in $10 a month. And I appreciate their support, their generosity, and I encourage you to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the sign-up link right under my mugshot on the homepage. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers anywhere around this world earn my bonus gift, the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. And the chaos is only growing in the greater Syrian war zone. It is a free-for-all. Or if you want to put up with a kind of off-color term, it's a clusterfuck. And it's only getting worse because, as of today, we have 16 American F-16 fighter jets. I'm sorry, six F-16s that have been deployed in southern Turkey at the Incirlik Air Base, along with 300 American personnel. So we have expanded the boots on the ground to support the wings in the air. And I'm not claiming a direct connection. But in the same news cycle, we have an unusual attack on the U.S. consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. And the government of Turkey has already identified the two women who fired shots at the U.S. consulate as members of a banned Marxist group. I'm skeptical of this kind of immediate tagging of people by the Turkish government, which, under the guise of joining the U.S. coalition in attacking the Islamic State, is busy killing Turkish Kurds. And this war has been provoked, we think, to prop up the political weakness of the President Erdogan, who is struggling to form a government because of losses in recent parliamentary elections. And in addition to that scene at the consulate in Istanbul, there were overnight bombings of an Istanbul police station and further unrest in other parts of the country. A total of 8 people were killed. And here's a comment from, I don't know this person, Ege Sekin, a Turkish analyst with IHS in London. Says, Turkey is now embroiled in a two-front war against the Kurds and the Islamic State, with its show of force against ISIS largely symbolic. Ankara's main priority is to weaken Kurdish rebels. Turkey is trying to further its interests across the region. This includes toppling Assad and consolidating control in the northern part of Syria. Well, this is just one element of an out-of-control situation. And the New York Times does a decent job in an analysis piece today about how the alliances that have been set up to try to take on both the Assad government and this Islamic State group are really strained. And the Kurdish fighters who have been repelling the Islamic State in towns like Kobani with tacit support from the U.S. airstrikes, they're now very worried that they're going to become targets of the Turkish airstrikes. And the fog of war, this confusion of the four-plus years of mayhem in Syria, is being used to settle these kinds of scores. And I think it's important because I believe most people who rely on the corporate media in this country for their information really don't have a clue of the complex layers of the conflict in Syria and Iraq. And I'll refer you to my conversation with Phyllis Bennis about 2 weeks ago, so it's now unrestricted. Even if you're not a subscriber, you can hear it at peterbcollins.com. But in her new primer on the Islamic State, she did a great job of analyzing the 7, 8, or 9 different wars that are being waged in Syria and, of course, also in Iraq at this time. So I'm glad to see the Times trying to educate its readers about what's really going on. And last week we told you how Division 30, that's the so-called moderate Syrian fighters that have been trained by the U.S. at the cost of $4 million a man. And I described how with defections and kidnappings, we've lost millions of dollars behind about a third of these Division 30 members who are out of action right now for one reason or another. And Division 30 announced that it's not going to be attacking the al-Nusra front because al-Nusra kidnapped their leader and an initial group of the soldiers. And now the al-Nusras have decided that they will not fight against the Islamic State, at least not in the northern part of Syria where Turkey is planning to set up a safe zone. And so this gets more and more complicated all the time, because you can't tell from one moment to the next who is an ally and who is a foe. And of course, a lot of these people aren't wearing uniforms or flying flags or banners or anything that identifies them. And there's a report that surfaced over the weekend that the British have a contingent of fighters in Syria who are posing as members of the Islamic State. It is a huge mess. And why the U.S. continues to be involved and Obama basically just ducks sharing the ugly news with the American people, it's beyond me. Obama is in a kind of wrestling match with AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which I contend is an illegal foreign lobby. And it's interesting because AIPAC set up a separate entity to fund the $20 or $25 million in TV ads that they're running to try to scuttle the deal with Iran. And in his speech last week that we brought you excerpts of on Thursday, Obama made the case that the people in Washington who are against the Iran deal are aligned, whether they like it or not, with the most extreme hardliners in Iran who are also opposed to the deal. And he was inferring that he was talking about AIPAC, but he didn't call them out by name. So sometime last week, it's not clear based on this article when it was, but there was a private meeting at the White House with the president and leaders of AIPAC. And he asked them to stop funding the lies that are being used to try to kill the Iranian deal. And they said, oh, that's not us. That's this other entity that we set up over here. And so it's interesting that there was a face-to-face meeting where Obama could confront his attackers. Now, I don't think that much happened beyond, you know, a sharing of disagreements. But I have to say that given all my criticism of Obama, he is trying in a way that doesn't make things worse to put limits on the influence of AIPAC. And one thing he could have mentioned at that meeting is what I told you at the outset here. Aren't you an illegal foreign lobby group? Maybe I ought to call over to the Justice Department and ask them to look into that. And meanwhile, it's no surprise to me, but Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York State, who clearly is more loyal to the government of Israel than that of the United States, finally announced on Thursday or Friday that he won't be supporting the Iran deal. That's hardly news, and as I said, not much of a surprise. But it is interesting that some Jewish members of Congress, like Adam Schiff of California, and I don't think Dick Durbin of Illinois is Jewish, but he has come out in favor of the deal, and Sandra Levin, a Jew from Detroit, member of the House, is in support. So the way it's shaping up, it does appear that the president can, there will be a bill passed rejecting the Iran deal. It'll be approved in both houses. It will be vetoed by the president, and that veto will be sustained, but at this point it looks like a narrow margin. As you know, there was a toddler, an 18-month-old boy, who died after the firebombing of his home in the West Bank about 10 days ago. And on Saturday, his father, who had been badly burned in that same firebombing, died as a result of those injuries. And in Israel, they're going through the motions of cracking down on extremist groups. They locked up a couple of more under the draconian standard, or the administrative detention program that is mostly used on Palestinians. And while I welcome any, even just attempts at justice, attempts at holding people accountable, I really don't consider this to be a sincere effort. Because the Netanyahu government should repudiate not only its statements, but its actions that have encouraged Jewish settlers and other extremists to virulently criticize Palestinians, to try to push them off their land, destroy their olive trees. All kinds of insults and humiliations and unfair actions are visited on the Palestinians on a daily basis. And so for the Israeli government to say we're going to crack down on these extremists, well, I view the government as filled with extremists, and I don't think that they have prisons large enough in Israel to hold them all if they do apply a realistic standard. The case of Tariq Ba-Oda continues to tie up the Obama administration. He's been on a hunger strike for several years now, since February of 2007. He weighs less than 75 pounds. He has been cleared for release. And yet the Obama administration is considering appealing a motion filed by attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights asking a judge to release this man before he dies. And Team Obama says, well, not yet. We need time to further consider internally the response to the petitioner's motion. And frankly, they're worried that if they let one hunger striker out because he's about to die, that others will copy that. And frankly, that is their problem. But it is just inhumane and cruel in ways that really defy description to keep a man who we cleared in 2009 simply because he grew up in Yemen. And Yemen is unstable because of our actions, because of the way we've used it as a shooting gallery for years now. And you're telling me there is no place on earth that they can put this man besides Guantanamo? I was mildly surprised to see that the jury in Aurora, Colorado, or Centennial, I think is where the courthouse is, announced its verdict for James Holmes on Friday. He is spared the death penalty because the jury could not reach a unanimous agreement on executing him. And I support this decision. I think he is truly insane. And the machinations to declare him fit for trial really were irrational, inexcusable. And while I haven't talked to any of these jurors, it seems that they got that. And finally, today, I want to tip you off that Jason Leopold has done it again through the Freedom of Information Act. He got the CIA to release a letter that was written by Leon Panetta when he ran the agency back in April of 2009. And it's a fascinating look into this letter where he notified the intelligence committees in Congress that following President Obama's directives, he was ending a contract with the company that we now know was involved in running the interrogations at the various black sites located around the world. Now, these were offshore torture centers. The U.S. spent $81 million just on the contract with the Mitchell, Jessen, and Associates. And Jason brought us the powerful interview with James Mitchell late last year. He was the psychologist hired by the military, and his firm got $81 million to essentially run these interrogation programs, including some of the kidnappings, which we call extraordinary rendition. So what's interesting about this is that in the letter, Panetta said that he was canceling the contract with Mitchell Jessen because we're no longer torturing people and we don't need these facilities. But the way the letter is written is a bit ambiguous, and it leaves you with two possible conclusions. One was that they actually did shut down these black sites, and the other is that they transferred them from the control of the contractor back to direct control by the CIA. And I hope you'll read it and see if you can figure out what Leon Panetta really meant when he sent that letter, and whether our government actually did follow through and end the torture programs that Obama said he would shut down. I want to thank you for joining me today for my news and comment podcast. This podcast is distributed every day, absolutely free, and you're welcome to share it with friends, colleagues, or even some Republicans. I'm Peter B. I'll be back here tomorrow, and I hope you will be too.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.